It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the cinemas and on DVD. Get ready for...
Wait for it!
Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Soze!
No, that's Matthew Soze.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever. Yeah.
Let's find out how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Soze.
What a story, Mark.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. Also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soce. This show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog, which will... We're going to start. I will be starting, hopefully, a series, a blog series.
Oh, a blog series.
Well, that's kind of redundant, isn't it?
No, I don't think so.
But I have something specifically for the blog.
Sure.
Which hopefully I will have more info for you next week, which you can check out at
filmsociology.tumblr.com.
The voice you just heard is a man who is hoping they.
We.
Meaning we. Yeah, he has his Beat the Heat T-shirt on, ready for game two tonight. That is Kobe Slagle.
Hello.
I, of course, have on my Red Wings jersey because they're up 3-1 against the Blackhawks.
Do they play tonight?
They do not. They shut out the Blackhawks.
Sorry. You guys don't play tonight?
No, we... As you can't tell, folks, I'm the person who makes fun of sports fans who use the term we, as if you, Mr. Slagle, are on the court or I am on the ice.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I'm dressed like a fat black or Red Wing, does not necessarily mean I'm a member of the team. So, anyway. Okay, we have a busy, busy show today. Now, full disclosure, I have to take off near the end of the show because the former kids film correspondent, she's still working here. We're just working on her title. Emma School Play is this evening. So, you know, I'm a dad. I have to go check that out and critique it. But, if you see me on the street, let me tell you about her play from last year. She was great. Rest of it, well, anyway. So we will be doing, I'll be playing for you an interview I did a while back, and I'm fine. This is one I wish I could have played it earlier, better late than never, but it's Chad Schaeffler, who is the director of the documentary Memphis Heat, which is about the history of professional wrestling in Memphis back in the day, back when it was a different time, Mr. Slagle.
Mm, 70s?
60s and 70s.
All right.
And, yeah, different time in the 80s. So anyway, we'll hear that, and then I think I'll have a couple of archive audio nuggets just to irritate Kobe, because as if the Red Wings jersey wasn't enough.
No, the Red Wings jersey's fine.
You're fine with that? Yeah. The other Detroit teams, however, well, the Pistons, you have a problem.
I don't know. It's just hockey.
You don't get hockey.
No.
Hockey is harmless.
It's harmless.
Really?
Yep.
You gotta get you. We have to get you on the ice. So, all right. Opening in theaters. Well, we have the animated film Epic from the creators of Ice Age, and I think it's the same producers who also gave us Rio, that film that wants to party and it wants to samba. Well, by the way, Cool Down tomorrow night.
That's right.
7 o'clock here on HD2 The Point. Mm-hmm. What do you got picked out, Mr. Slagle?
It will be a repeat of last week's Cool Down Essentials, featuring the debut self-titled album from Seu.
Very good. Mm-hmm. So, also opening in theaters, we have Fast and Furious 6.
Six Fast, Six Furious.
But it's strange because that's what I thought it would be called, except they just decided to call it a plain Fast and Furious 6.
But you didn't see it, so we don't know if it's six awesome.
Nobody said that, did they?
I don't know.
Okay,
no, I'm saying that.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me give you a little insight at the day-to-day life of a film critic like yours truly. Sometimes we miss a film for whatever reason, and we have to review something. Yes, I missed Fast and Furious 6. I'm sorry. The screening for this was on Wednesday, and I was at home doing family stuff. Not plot things, family stuff. And
you were You were doing family stuff. Meanwhile, in the theater, there were plot things.
Plot things were happening. That's right. Our new favorite term here at Film Sociology, plot things.
Plot things between movie, between story characters.
Plot things happen. Yep. So anyway, So I missed that, and of course it opened today, but I was on the board on HD1. Normally, if I miss a film, I can usually go to a 10 a.m. or a 1 p.m. screening, but I did not because I was working. So that, with that in mind, there was a film that opened yesterday in theaters. It's so special. It opened on a Thursday, and I think part of it was so they could get a little extra money going into the weekend, going up against the Fast and Furious franchise. And yes, The Hangover Part 3, co-written and directed by Todd Phillips. Everybody's back for this because, really, if you think about it, it's everybody's bread and butter. Although, although Bradley Cooper's got a nomination now, so he's ready to move on to the next chapter of his career. So Bradley Cooper, Zach Galifianakis, Ed Helms, your guy. Is he on your guy list? Because you are a big fan of Cedar Rapids.
Yeah, I love Cedar Rapids.
It is Kobe endorsed. the Kobe Slagle stamp of approval, that is that. And Ken Jeong, am I saying that right? Is Mr. Chow. Is in this, as well as Justin Bartha. Yes, Heather Graham shows up, and John Goodman's in it. Sorry, no Mike Tyson. Deal with it. Anyway.
But there is John Goodman, so you do have that.
Yeah, he didn't bite anybody's ear off or rape anybody, so.
I'd rather have John Goodman in a movie than Tyson.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree. So, at least that film has that going for it.
Yeah.
All right, here's the other, and by the way, this is a Green Band trailer, just so there's no confusion whatsoever. Here we go.
My God, it's got the voice of an angel.
It's breathtaking.
I would never come back.
Don't worry. It all ends tonight.
Someone needs to burn this place to the ground.
Ooh, I like that.
Lisa, can you remember me? I'm the one that picked the object. Lisa, can you remember me? I'm the one that picked the object.
We've been on a lot of adventures together, but it seems like you haven't learned anything. Anything.
I'll be in the limo.
My name's Alan, and I bought a giraffe. Oh, my life is great.
You know, visual jokes don't play well when we're doing a radio show.
No. I was wondering if we were going to be talking, sidebar here, I was wondering if we were going to be talking much at all about Six Fast, Six Furious, because in some of the trailers that have been running on TV and on radio, there are, I heard one yesterday.
Yeah.
Counted three total words, not lines.
Words. Actual words.
Three actual
English random words.
Of dialogue.
And that was it.
In the trailer. The rest was rock music and crashing and explosions. And
Vin Diesel saying, would, or something.
I think it was ride or die, and then
and
then roll with all the car sounds and explosions.
He still lives his life a quarter mile at a time.
I don't know why.
Okay. maybe we'll break down the audio next on next week's show. We'll see. Okay. I've learned from watching this and with The Hangover. Now, this was a comedy when the very first one. Let's go back to the beginning. This is a film that I remember liking, but I would probably like a lot more if I were 20 or 30 years younger.
I remember seeing it.
I'm asking because you're a little closer, I think, to the audience that they're shooting for.
The college kids that are stoked. Bro,
you're 98% of college men.
Yeah.
No. So your initial response at the time.
I saw the original one. I did not see two. I don't plan on seeing three, but I saw the original one, not in theaters, but I guess sort of after the fact.
Sure.
And wasn't really impressed.
Over.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't really anything new.
Your tears weren't jerked.
No. It's a mismatched group of guys.
It is a mismatched group of guys, and it does take the concept of what happened the night before and the puzzle. I get that. But I think raunchy comedy. I was explaining this to Emma. This was hard hitting daddy daughter time this week. I think R-rated raunchy comedies. Every generation, well, at least my generation, has had one. We go back to Animal House or Kentucky Fried Movie, and of course we talked about Hollywood Nights and then Porky's.
Hollywood Nights is great.
Yeah. So I think every generation has one. Then you have American Pie for the next generation. So every few years there is a landmark or a watermark of raunchy comedies, and The Hangover is one of them because it turned out to be a huge success, much bigger than anybody anticipated, and it launched the careers of pretty much the three guys involved.
Yeah.
And this, again,
maybe not necessarily launched,
but it put it out. No, you're right. It put it into a new stratosphere. Yeah, because Bradley Cooper, we knew, was the jerk in Wedding Crashers, among other things. And from Inside the Actors Studio.
Yes, Ed Helms was on The Office.
And Zach Galifianakis stand-up
was a comedian,
Well but, it did put them into stardom, we'll say that. So anyway, funny film, but again, I think I was too old for it, but I still enjoyed it. Hangover 2, exact same concept, but in Bangkok. This one, the concept that makes the film title is not used until the very end. And that's not the reason why it bothered me. In fact, I'm glad they didn't do it a third time. But yes, there is the four guys are brought up. Even if they called it the Wolf Pack, that would have made a little more sense. But then that would confuse people because there's no hangover in the title. Right. So, but yeah, they... Justin Bartha, of course, is barely in the film because they have to get him because John Goodman's involved and there's some bad dealings with Mr. Chow. And it just seems like everybody's going through the motions. And even Zach Galifianakis' character, Alan, who is supposed, is supposed to be the third or actually the fourth wheel, in a real pain. But he's really...
It's just old.
It is old and tiresome. Yep. And he watching his character, that you heard the scene with the giraffe. The very first scene, he's driving with a blatantly obvious computer-generated giraffe in the back of his vehicle. And, of course, something bad happens to the giraffe. But that's the very first scene, and it doesn't get any better because I didn't think that was funny to begin with. But Galifianakis' performance as Alan reminded me of... Well, how you feel when Detroit's doing really well in the playoffs. And I believe that word is insufferable.
Insufferable.
So,
yeah, to me...
He feels more irritating than normal.
Yeah, it was old the second time around.
So
kind of like the Vince Vaughn talking real fast and saying a lot of things.
Right.
And...
So not needed at all. Really not needed at all. So
the only thing that makes this one stand out at all... is that the characters are a little more annoying than they usually are in these kind of movies.
Absolutely correct, Ed Johnson. Thank you.
You just go see that in the theater, you laugh about it, and you go home.
But I didn't laugh. I chuckled a couple times maybe, but that's about it. That's not worth the AMC bucks. So there's that. Kobe, what is happening at your... is there anything actually? Because it's
actually
a holiday weekend.
Have it ready yet.
Should we take a break and then we'll go into DVD and Blu-ray?
Hey,
and
you know what we could do?
What could we do?
We could take a break.
Hey, actually, no, wait. I'm sorry. Scratch that. I forgot to mention, on Monday, of course, last week's show, we had my very fun interview with actor Jason Mewes, who's now a producer and a director as well. And Monday at Clues...
a massive iTunes bill.
Yes. Monday at Clues Memorial Hall here at Butler University. Here? Over at Butler University. I got to watch Jay and Silent Bob's super groovy cartoon movie.
And it was a fun evening. Another film, it's an animated feature, and it is kind of Blunt Man and Chronic Begins, their version of that. Nice Valentine to the superhero movies. Fun. I probably, again, would have liked it a lot more. I probably would have thought it was more hysterical if I were maybe 10 or 20 years younger, maybe 30. But I still enjoyed myself because it's fun watching these characters. So it was like an hour and 20-minute film with some features and some commercials that Jay and Jason Mewes and Kevin Smith were in. And then there was an intermission. And then there was a podcast Q&A. That went, the show went over 3 hours. So it was a lot of fun. It was good seeing the guys up there. And so anyway, good times are had by all. Do not know, I know my buddy JC asked if there is a video release yet of the cartoon movie. Have not heard of one yet. So you might want to go to viewaskew.com or check out Jay and Silent Bob's Super Groovy Cartoon Movie. I believe it has its own website. But you can check that out and see if there is a release date. But yeah, it was fun. Not as funny as the animated series Clerks that was on ABC, but still enjoyable. So there, did that buy you enough time?
Yeah.
That was an actual content.
That was good.
Okay, thank you. As opposed to, you know, food and sports talk here on the film show.
Tonight at IU Cinema, and actually all this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, The Reluctant Fundamentalist.
Ah, the Millionaire film. Very good.
Yep.
Very good. And anything at the IMA?
Nothing at the IMA this week. Next week, we have Style Wars at the Toby at 7 p.m. And next week begins Midnight Movies at Keystone Landmark.
Anchorman. I think I'll have to check with the Smarter Two-Thirds.
Man, I want to go to that.
We'll have to check and see. There might be, ladies and gentlemen, a film sociology road trip or field trip. Or maybe if you recognize us, maybe we'll get you a prize. And not just us at the bar talking really loudly. You know, Kobe Slagle. What, Matthew Sosi? That was a good show we did this evening.
What was that show that we did this evening?
Film sociology on HD to the point. No, we won't do that. So, all right, let's take a short break. We'll talk about what is new and old on DVD and Blu-ray. We'll go into the archives. We have some dead people we like. And then my interview with Memphis Heat director Chad Schaeffler. Sorry. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the point and WFYI.org.
Sir.
What?
Are either one of these any good?
I don't watch movies.
Well, have you heard anything about either one of them?
I find it's best to stay out of other people's affairs. You know who I can do without? I can do without the people in the video store.
Which ones?
All of them.
What would you get for a 6-year-old boy who chronically wets his bed?
So do you have any new movies in?
Do you have that one with that guy who was in that movie that was out last year?
They never rent quality flicks. They always pick the most intellectually devoid movie on the racks.
Ooh, Navy SEALs!
It's like in order to join, they have to have an IQ less than their shoe size.
Just go open the video store.
Yeah, open the video store!
Blockbuster Video! Wow, what a difference!
Well, in case you didn't see it, here it is again.
Boy, he's geared up and ready for game two tonight, yes, isn't he? Welcome back to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msosi@WFYI.org, also on Facebook, also on Twitter at Matthew Sosi. Hanging out with Kobe Slagle. A little later on, you'll hear my interview with director Chad Schaeffler of the pro wrestling documentary Memphis Heat, the history of Memphis wrestling. Wrestling.
Not wrestling.
And
wrestling.
And when you say wrestling, the W is optional. Could really go either way. Dash R or WR. So, okay. Quite a few titles on DVD and Blu-ray. And we'll start with, first we had, apparently, you know, the Planet Hollywood reunion tour. Of course, of Stallone, Willis, and Schwarzenegger. They all appeared in The Expendables 2. And Sly's film came out on DVD earlier, Bullet to the Head, if I remember correctly. And, of course, A Good Day to Die Hard will be coming out in video soon. So this week it's Arnold's return to starring in a film, this time called The Last Stand, where he plays a small-town sheriff in a border town in Arizona, and some bad dudes, a bad guy. Say goodbye to the bad guy. He's on his way. Main villain's broken out of prison, and he's going to be driving through the small town, trying to get into Mexico with a super speedy, souped-up Corvette. And the overqualified Forrest Whitaker is involved as an FBI agent out to catch the bad guys. And let's see, you have, by the way, Arnold's one of his deputies, Luis Guzman. And you also have Johnny Knoxville providing comic relief. That's with finger quotes. But ladies and gentlemen, here you go. Here's the trailer to Arnold's film, The Last Stand.
Get out, get away. It's going to be an explosion. Get to the chopper, now. Get to the chopper, now. Get to the chopper, get down. Get to the chopper, now. To the chopper, now. He's like, I'm here, kill me. Come on, do it.
Thank you, Aries Spears, for providing the audio to that trailer. You didn't see that one coming in.
No, that was good. Look at this. See, I'm on the receiving end.
I did that all
end.
By myself. You see, it happens from time to time. Okay, so Arnold's back. And, of course, this was going to be part of his kind of big next chapter in his life, because he has the book, he had his autobiography, and he had the movie, and he's trying not to talk about the kid he had with the maid, and he's just moving on. Well, this is a film that I finally, as I watched it, I mean, it's directed by Korean director Kim Ji-woon, who is probably best known for giving us the Korean Western, The Good, the Bad, the Weird, which I still need to check out. But so I wondered if this was going to be an over-the-top, ridiculous action film like Machete or Red, and it isn't, although it has its moments. I actually recommended Sly's film, Bullet to the Head, because it's directed by Walter Hill, and it just wanted to be an early 80s action movie. It wanted to be another 48 Hours. Not another 48 Hours, the original 48 Hours. And this film was kind of stuck in between that. Yes, Arnold is old and he admits it, and not as spry as he once was, but that's not enough to carry the picture. However, I thought finally about three quarters of the way through this film, these are the two, Sly and Arnold, should have gotten the grindhouse treatment. If you had done a 70-minute version of Bullet to the Head and a 70-minute version of The Last Stand and treated them together like grindhouse with trailers and whatnot, that would have been a lot of fun. But this one was about an hour and 45 minutes, and you know, just waiting for the big setup for the big shootouts and gunplay at the end of the film, and it just wasn't enough time, and too short,
and
too bad.
Various chicanery
and plot things. So yeah, so not as fun as one really hoped. So, and by the way, there's a standoff, and yes, there are gunfights, and there's a fist fight literally at the border between Arnold and the bad guy. So, not giving away a whole heck of a lot, but you got an audio there?
Otto, don't flatter yourself. It wasn't that great.
Indeed. Okay, also on DVD and Blu-ray this week, there's another one that I missed called Stand Up Guys. And this intrigued me because this is the film with Al Pacino,
yes,
Christopher Walken, and Alan Arkin. And it's directed by Fisher Stevens, actor now turned director producer. And Pacino's released from prison, and Walken is not only going to his old time friend and picks him up from prison and takes him out for a night out, but as we found out, also has been made to put a hit on Pacino for Pacino's crime, which landed him in jail. And then about maybe about a half hour into the film is when they pick up Alan Arkin. They actually break into a retirement home and get him out. And they steal a car and they drive real fast. And they drive fast and reckless, but it's funny because they're old.
Nah.
You see? So the first half hour when it's just walking and Pacino going out, getting drinks, hitting on girls, when Pacino winds up dancing with a girl, not quite like Scent of a Woman, but might make you remember that. But there was a film that I kept thinking of called Mikey and Nikki. And this was a film written and directed by Elaine May, and it looked like a Cassavetes film, but it wasn't. It had John Cassavetes and Peter Falk in it. Cassavetes plays a guy who thinks a mobster's out to kill him. He calls his childhood friend Peter Falk, and they pretty much run through the city all night long. And this film had that feeling. And I hate to say it, but when Alan Arkin showed up and more plot things happened, like they discover a girl tied up naked in the trunk of the car that they stole, even though they had driven in it for a long time and there was no noise in the trunk whatsoever. And there gets to be some slow motion action sequences that just dumbs down the film. And that's kind of a bummer, especially when you have three very talented people like Pacino, Walken, and Arkin. It's kind of like Righteous Kill. De Niro and Pacino are like, this is the best you guys could come up with for these two. Only in this case, it's these three. Fisher Stevens obviously likes these three actors, and who wouldn't? But they deserve better than this.
It just really didn't do anything for me.
No, it did not. Also out this week, Parker, which was the Jason Statham film where he's not always kicking somebody in the face. That was happening from time to time. This was one directed by Taylor Hackford, a.k.a. Mr. Helen Mirren, with Jennifer Lopez, Michael Chiklis, Nick Nolte. And it's kind of a variation or a remake of the film Point Blank, which was a remake of Point Blank, which was later remade as Payback with Mel Gibson, where Statham is done wrong and he's going to go and get revenge upon everybody else. He actually had a real director behind this one, which helps. So that's worth a rental. Also worth a rental is the latest from Steven Soderbergh, although his new film goes on HBO Sunday, Behind the Candelabra. That's the one with Michael Douglas as Liberace and Matt Damon as his lover.
Yes.
But Soderbergh directed Side Effects, which had Rooney Mara and Channing Tatum, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Jude Law, and it's a woman who, she takes some medication, and guess what? It has side effects. So that's, and then bad things happen, and it's a statement on the prescription drug industry as we know it. So there you go. All right, and then there's the ABCs of Death, 26 directors, 26 ways. Kobe's not watching that.
Mm-mm.
All right, nope. I'm gonna move into the archives, since we're kind of short on time. So these are films that you can buy online. You can't get them in stores, or as Kobe likes to put it,
yeah, I'll burn it for like $5.
Yeah, only in this case maybe 15. And I should have done this a couple of weeks ago, but I watched this because I was inspired by IRT's production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which was a lot of fun to watch. So I found the 1968 film version of the Royal Shakespeare Company's production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Check out this cast: David Warner as Lysander, a young Helen Mirren as Hermia, a young Diana Rigg as Helena, a young Judi Dench as Titania, and Ian Holm as Puck. And yes, the fairies are in green paint, and they have Vulcan ears. Really good actors, really good performances. The problem was it looks like it was made for £4. It looked like it was shot in somebody's yard, and there are literally scenes of two people, and they're behind a complete darkness with three single lights pointed. It looks like it was shot in a studio in total darkness except for three light bulbs. And I think this was a great example of a film where they didn't think down the road that this would be put on video. You would only see it in theaters once, you may see it on TV once, and that's about it. There would be no pause button for you to see how cheap this film can be at times. And the makeup is really weird because they're really green in the face, and in the body, not so much.
Y'all love it. So,
y'all.
Yeah. So, anyway, different take. Enjoyed the actors, but yeah, kind of cheap looking. And that's a shame because it's Shakespeare, your guy. So, all right, moving on quickly to Dead People We Like.
Doing our, the annual show of Dead People We Like.
There's a pretty big one this
we
week.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like. Yes.
And these are two best known, especially in their obits, as TV actors, but I always like going through their IMDb files to find out what films they did and if it made you go, oh, yeah.
Oh, that guy.
No way. But actress Christine White died at the age of 86 last week, and she is best known for, did a lot of TV, but she was known as William Shatner's wife in the famous Twilight Zone episode, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. You're not a Twilight Zone guy?
I can handle Twilight.
But this is the one, you know, where Shatner thinks he sees a creature on the on the wing of the plane.
Not seen that one.
You should really check that out. It's freaky, but it's short.
Yeah.
Like me. But anyway, and then in the picture, she looks like Lee Grant. Anyway, she did a lot of TV like Bonanza, The Rifleman, The Untouchables, Father Knows Best. But she was also in films like Man Crazy, Panama Sal, Macabre, or as Bill Hader, as Vincent Price likes to say, Macabre. And she played Carol McCoy in Magnum Force, the second Dirty Harry film. She plays the wife of one of the slain partners of Clint Eastwood. And then you have Steve Forrest, who also did a lot of TV and some movies, best known as the leader of SWAT back in 75, 76. I know Kobe has the theme in his collection somewhere. He probably should. But he also appeared in films like Prisoner of War with Ronald Reagan. He was in Flaming Star with Elvis. He was in North Dallas 40, Mommy Dearest, Heller in Pink Tights with George Cukor. He was actually one of 97 actors in The Longest Day. And but yeah, best known as Hondo in SWAT. And he even had a cameo as an older police officer in the remake of SWAT, which had Samuel L. Jackson, Jeremy Renner, and Colin Farrell. So there's that. Now you have the theme from SWAT stuck in your head, don't you, mister? All right, ladies and gentlemen, I have to go see Emma's show, so I will send her all of your regards. But there is a very cool documentary that is from 2011, and I didn't find out about it until the Sklar brothers. And by the way, they have a podcast that's a lot of fun.
Sklar, like Leland Sklar?
As in the two guys that used to host Cheap Seats on ESPN Classic.
Okay, no, never mind.
No. Like the sports version of Mystery Science Theater. They're twin brother comedians, and they're very funny. But they talked about one of the highlights they had from last year. One of the cultural highlights was this documentary called Memphis Heat, which is about the true story, the history of Memphis wrestling. You crack up at that. You've never heard that said?
No, I've heard that said.
Just not done by the smart guy in the Red Wings jersey.
Not with such frequency.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I tell you what.
What?
You know what kind of dressing I like? Italian. And then I wash my clothes. But not in the crick.
That's terrible.
That is terrible. You know, it's not terrible.
It's not terrible.
So, anyway.
It's not terrible.
No, it's not. And good luck in game two. Anyway, here is my interview with Memphis Heat director Chad Schaeffler. Joining me on Film Sociology right now, the director of Memphis Heat, Chad Schaeffler. Chad, how are you, my friend?
Very good, very good. Thanks for having me on the show.
My pleasure. Now, I'm just curious, what is your, before the documentary, what was your history with professional wrestling?
Well, I grew up in Memphis. So right there, there's history.
didn't Jerry Lawler visit your crib when you were born? Doesn't he do that with the new babies?
You know, he didn't visit mine, but I know a few people he did. So. but yeah, you know, just growing up in Memphis, I mean, it was such a culture, especially when I was a kid in the late 70s and early 80s. I mean, I was kind of at the perfect age, you know, I was in third to, you know, sixth, seventh grade, that kind of world. And you know, you saw it every Saturday. You went to the Coliseum. You idolized the guys. So it was a pretty huge deal. And you got to see a lot of blood.
Yes, before health and other things got in the way.
Exactly. And so I think that was the big draw. It's like, cool.
My wife has a term, may buy boys for boys.
That's, I think, pretty accurate.
Well, I told you before the interview, my father was a ringside physician for boxing and wrestling in Michigan in the late 60s, early 70s. So, you know, guys, you know, like folks that would probably drive through Memphis on a visit, like Dick the Bruiser, Bobo Brazil, Crusher, you know, Wildman Furpo, Haystacks Calhoun, those guys. And, of course, I'm about the same age, so this was back when there were different regions of wrestling. And if you read the magazines, which I shamelessly did, you know, Memphis was one of the most fascinating. It just seemed like there was always a lot of activity and a lot of a real rabid fan base. And like you said, it was on television once a week, and the matches at the Coliseum were once a month, or were there more?
They were weekly.
Weekly,
yeah,
wow.
Were every Monday night. So it was, it was pretty crazy. You know, just as big as it was in the city, and there's a lot of reasons and a lot of speculation on why. I think it was a combination of a really great promoters who worked really hard to build the territory in this region. The combination of that with television, because we were really, you know, first doing this live TV show, was gigantic. And then you I think happened to have just a bunch of superstars that all hit at once. I mean, you kind of had Fargo and Handsome Jimmy, and then of course Lawler and Bill Dundee. And, you know, those guys all kind of came up at the same time, and so it became a hotbed for wrestlers. You know, they wanted to come to Memphis because it was like the proving ground for a while. And I mean, I think it's also helped by the fact that we didn't have any professional sports. You know, we had the Memphis Chicks minor league baseball, and that was it.
And college sports.
Yeah, exactly. So people, I think, didn't have that sports outlet that you had in other markets. And so, you know, wrestling became that outlet for people. So it was pretty monstrous. I mean, they sold out the Coliseum, which was, gosh, 13,000-15,000, something like that, you know, every Monday for a long time, more often than Elvis.
So when did you get the idea to make the documentary?
I was actually approached by a guy named Sherman Wilmot and Ron Hall. They were working on a book. They had found a bunch of kind of old photography from kind of really the 50s, but some stuff from the 40s, 50s, 60s. And they were like, let's do a companion piece and video. And I think, you know, the original thought was, let's, you know, 30 minutes, little local, you know, PBS kind of thing. And as we started to make calls and get into it, and wrestlers were interested in doing the interviews, you know, it kind of snowballed and blew up from there. So that was kind of the genesis of the project was from Sherman and Ron and their book that they were working on.
Well, I think that the timing for I know this was it officially released in 2011 or hit the festival circuit in 11 and 12.
Yeah, that's right. That's correct.
Okay, well, one of the things that intrigued me was this is a documentary that is following up now, you know, many, many years ago, but you had Beyond the Mat, which was at times a not-so-flattering piece on individual wrestlers, and then you had the film The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke, which kind of showed one aspect of the realities of being an aging wrestler. But this was a combination of a kind of a Valentine, but really an inside look at that scene. And one of the things that really impressed me was how many of these guys you got to and how many of them are still around.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were a little surprised as well. You know, it really helped when we got, I think it was Jerry Lawler said, I'll do it. And he helped us. He championed the film and, you know, gave us phone numbers, shared contacts, made some calls for us. And as soon as that started happening, I think it, you know, I won't say it was a one-upmanship, but it was like everybody, okay, Jerry's in it, I need to be in it too. And so we had that little bit of an effect, I think, which was great. And yeah, they're all around, and they're mostly still, you know, loosely involved. I mean, they have there's a big group of the old-time wrestlers that meet up every year in Florida, and it's like kind of a secret society, apparently. Like you can't, not just anybody can go to it, you have to have been a wrestler. But they still keep up with each other and are still involved in some ways. Handsome Jimmy has a wrestling camp he does what's the town? It's in West Virginia. It's near Virginia Tech. But okay. So he still does his wrestling camp. Buddy Wayne, his son, is still involved doing a little local wrestling promotion. So yeah, it's pretty crazy. They all still kind of are involved and living it, so it's pretty amazing.
Well, I say, I'm curious, who was, when you interviewed them, who was the least like their persona, and who was more than their actual persona?
I would say more than their persona was Fargo. I mean, he was always a big character, but he was still that guy. I mean, he was definitely that guy still. And he's, I mean, total rabble-rouser, which was what was so great. I mean, constantly contradicting everything we would think. And it was almost like he knew it. He was laughing when he did it. As far as the least, like, their personality, they all seem to be very much in the world of who their characters are as a wrestler. So I didn't see a lot of, huge variations from that. In some ways, Lawler, because he's the most low-key about his persona, his wrestling persona. He and Dundee both were very real. It was less about their character and just really about kind of a genuine and kind of an honesty to their responses. They weren't really distracted by who they portrayed their wrestling career as to who they were now. So that was pretty interesting.
Well, a couple of things also that intrigue me, and for those who've never really seen a documentary or seen a film about wrestling, I think it addresses this well. One is you can say what you will about the quote unquote validity of wrestling. This took a toll on many a man's body and many a woman's body, and so that is brought up, as well as the amount of driving, the amount of travel that these guys had to do.
Yeah, it's amazing more guys didn't die in car wrecks, because they were really on the road all the time, and a lot of times late at night. I mean, Lawler's telling us, I'm not sure if it's in the movie so much, but finishing up a match in Nashville and turning around and driving home to Memphis at 2 a.m. and then getting up that next morning at 10, 11, heading to Birmingham. And all the guys just constantly drove. But one thing they did a lot of times, not all the time, they would stay in the towns, but they also would drive home after these matches sometimes. So that it was crazy. I think they said 100,000 miles a year or something like that on their cars. I mean, just a really staggering number.
And I know Jimmy Hart was a musician, so he the parallels between being on the road as a musician and being on the road as a wrestler were very, very similar.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was something we hit on a little bit in the movie. And we actually, when we first set out to do the film, we wanted to make even more of a parallel between the music side and rock and roll and wrestling. We kind of found ourselves just gravitating towards just wrestling and staying away from the music side. But we did try to inject a lot of local music and use local musicians for all the soundtrack stuff. So.
Well, that, and as you said, a Coliseum of 15,000 got sold out every week. So these guys were kind of like rock stars in their community.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they couldn't go anywhere without getting mobbed. I mean, that was the thing. And the bad guys, people believed were bad guys. So, they would, you Handsome Jimmy's like, man, my car would get keyed, people would break windows, they would cut the tires. It's in the movies. Like, I didn't want people to know my kid was my kid because I didn't want to get picked on at school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was crazy how much, people really did buy into wrestling and believe it as it was happening. And I think, infected their lives, both good and bad.
Now, actually, how did Andy Kaufman get involved with Memphis?
My understanding is he actually called up it started, he was trying to do it through McMahon's company. He approached them with this idea of him coming in and wrestling women, and McMahon was not interested. And I think this was Vince Sr. It was McMahon's father.
Yeah, because I think if Junior was in charge, he would have done it immediately.
He would have done it. And I think he even has come on his own record as saying, I wanted to do it. My dad didn't. So Vince Sr. didn't want to do it. Memphis was kind of the next big thing in order. And so he called up, Lawler directly and said, hey, I've got this idea. And, they said, come on down, let's do it. and it was on. And that was really, I mean, that for me personally, and it's kind of cliched, but that is the moment for me, is my childhood experience with wrestling. Is that whole "I'm from Hollywood, you're too dumb,"
yep,
"you're a bunch of rednecks from Memphis." I mean, everybody was up in arms about it. I mean, every kid, every parent, everybody just thought it was you know, the most ridiculous thing was angry about it. So it still sticks with me. I mean, I remember, you know, tuning in to see what was that jerk going to do next.
And it put Memphis wrestling on the map. I mean, the national news covered this.
It did. It became huge. And then, of course, the Letterman, the whole Letterman yep. thing was crazy. And, you know, my understanding is that Letterman was not in on that at all. Lawler and Kaufman were in on it. They knew what they were going to do to some degree, but Letterman had no idea. So it's pretty brilliant stuff.
And yet Letterman would let Brother Theodore on his show on a regular basis.
Yeah, exactly.
So you mentioned Vince McMahon. Was it McMahon's hands dipping into the talent that caused a bit of a downfall? I mean, and it wasn't just Memphis. I know regional wrestling in and of itself just kind of dissolved for the most part, not entirely. But was that an influence?
I would say that was the big thing, that in the onset of cable television, which was also, you know, McMahon and the pay-per-view, between Turner and McMahon, you kind of killed the regional thing. But they were definitely poaching lots of talent, and that became a huge issue. And I know it became actually a point of contention among wrestlers locally and, you know, personally, you know, people really got offended when, you know, somebody would say, I'm leaving this production to go be with McMahon, even if it made more sense for them financially, for their families and stuff. But it really, I think, you know, was the kind of thing that was taken very personally by people. And there's no doubt that they were picking off anybody that would listen. And, you know, eventually I think see so many of these guys wound up with Vince at some point in their careers. So.
Well, say after that, was the WWF, now WWE, and the NWA, now WC, then WCW, would they do matches in Tennessee after that?
They did. There were some cross-promotional things. Gosh, I'm blanking. There was a pretty big one in the 80s that Lawler went up and I think did some WWF, and then they sent guys down here at the same time. Maybe it was... not Ric Flair, but Savage. That one.
Okay.
I think that was a WWF cross promotion.
I see.
Yeah. So they definitely participated. And they were definitely, you know, would talk. I think they probably secretly wished Vince would have, you know, offered to buy the territory, but that never did happen. So
what's the Memphis scene like today?
You know, I don't know that there really is much of one. There's been a kind of steady talk of revival. Jerry Lawler did put on some kind of live wrestling shows in the last couple of years, and he's also was even doing a little TV thing again that was didn't really ever get any traction, mainly because you know they put it on at 11:30 at night on a Friday night or something, and so just, you know, he had no chance with it. And so there's really not a ton going on. There's some local talent that's around that are still, you know, trying to get on the, you know, whatever it is, the WWE these days. And there's like Ken Wayne's doing his wrestling school. So there's definitely activity, and I think there's still so many fans, you know, which is one thing we found with the film, is that when we were given a 1 week run at a local theater, it was selling out most nights, and then it was like they extended it 3 weeks and it sold well the entire time. So we were really, really lucky, but it also really pointed the finger to how big this still is to people and how much it meant to them in their lives. So it's pretty fantastic.
I was going to say, how many film festivals and how many wrestling events? What was the ratio?
We did not do a lot of festivals. It was interesting. We kind of went with the self-promotion approach, which was a little bit different than normal, where we actually wound up in a bunch of theaters in the region for like a 1 week run, and I think we wound up in a half dozen or so theaters. We did three or four film festivals, and then there were a couple of wrestling events it's shown at, but not a ton. We self-distributed the DVD, and then we're able to get on iTunes and Amazon, so it is available for streaming or for download, and then to purchase through our website, which the DVD, I don't know if you saw the DVD, but it has 4 hours of extra footage.
Yes, so, we appreciate that. It saves me from watching matches on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's pretty nice to have all that in one place. And it has the Galento story on it, which I love. That story was great, and unfortunately couldn't make it in the film, but was able to be at least as an extra on the DVD. So
tell the website so folks can look it up.
It is memphisheat-themovie.com. And then it's also on Amazon and iTunes. I think if you look up Memphis Heat, the true story of Memphis wrestling, you shouldn't have any trouble finding it.
That's with an R, not a W.
Correct.
I would say that I found out about it because the Sklar brothers praised it as one of the top films of last year.
Yeah, I know. We were totally shocked by that. We all kind of like, holy cow. I had a friend of mine send it to me randomly. I hadn't even seen it, and I was like, really?
Well, it's funny you mention it because I know the WWE owns a lot of the old archival footage for a lot of matches, and they put out a bunch of stuff. I know they put out their own version of the Von Erich family saga and WCCW, but it always has that feeling of it's under his umbrella, and the fact that your film is a regional Valentine to that scene. It's not a corporate event, and I think that shows when you watch it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I definitely think we were trying to pick up on the ethos of the time and kind of have it come through our film. And that's the same way when we promoted it, it was kind of the same idea. Let's mimic the circuit, if you will.
Well, Chad, I really, really appreciate your time. And, have a Dyer's hamburger for me.
Oh, will do, man. You take it easy. And thanks for having us on the show.
Hey, what up? Jason Hughes here. You're listening to WFYI Indy, man. Film sociology up in this PCHR stage.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Padma Lakshmi.
Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Padma. How are you?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
We're hanging here in Indianapolis.
I'm good. We're just, we're sitting here drinking up some coffee. Very happy. Jittery people.
Well, that's good to know. When it comes to summer, what is the first dish that you think of?
Well, I think there's nothing so classic in summer as ice cream. And I'm going to show you how to dress up ice cream and make it into a fabulous dessert and give your guests a coffee all rolled into one. And the recipe is so easy, but if you don't write it down, it's on Nespresso.com. Basically, Nespresso makes these great espresso machines. Their coffee machines are renowned all over the world. And they basically have a Pixie machine, which is the one I love. It comes in a lot of colors. You pop the little capsule of coffee in. It's the best possible coffee. You make the espresso. You just take a beautiful, simple scoop of vanilla ice cream, put it in a coffee cup, pour the espresso hot over it, sprinkle some chocolate chips, and drizzle some caramel sauce. That is it. You could add nuts, you could add cinnamon, you could add peanut butter chips, but that's the basic recipe. And again, if your viewers are, if your listeners are driving or whatever, it's on the website. Go to Nespresso.com.
Sounds like a good movie treat as well.
It's awesome, honestly. They have this beautiful milk machine called the Arachino, and it's basically you just plug it in and it steams up the milk and gives you that foam, just like those high-end coffee bars all across Italy and Switzerland and France. It foams everything up. It steams the milk in 1 second. It's beautiful, actually probably about 30 seconds, but it's so easy to do.
Well, can you tell us a little bit of what's in store for season 10 of Top Chef?
Well, we haven't filmed it yet, so there's not much I can tell you. We're in pre-production right now. I think we're just all racking our brains and figuring out how we're going to top Texas from last season. I mean, we had such an incredible, incredible season, and we're just gearing to shoot. It'll probably be on the fall, and I think we're trying to shake it up again. I think you'll see a lot of surprises. I mean, Charlize Theron and Patti LaBelle were on last season, so who knows who they'll come up with this season.
Padma, we can top Texas, Indianapolis.
Sounds good to me.
So I was curious, when you see somebody cooking in a movie, do you pay extra special attention to see if they're actually doing it right?
That's a great question. I do, actually. I'm a big freak about continuity because, I come from theater and I've done a couple of movies, and so I can always tell when there's not continuity or when someone's phoning it in. And, that scene in Jerry Maguire where Renee Zellweger answers the door. Watch it. When they cut to his view, her necklace is tied differently.
Ah, yes. So who can, movie-wise, who can cook?
You know what? Stanley Tucci can cook his face off. That is not, he is not playing. Everything in Big Night is very authentic.
Great
so
film.
So can Martin Scorsese. His first student film was a film about his mom's spaghetti sauce. He gave me a copy of it. It's brilliant.
And didn't she do all the cooking in that one kitchen scene in Goodfellas?
Yes. That's an incredible scene.
So anytime we're going to see you in a movie anytime soon?
I have a couple offers, but my problem is my scheduling. You know, mm-hmm. you have to really do one thing and do it well. I haven't been in a movie since I started Top Chef 5 years ago. My last film was for the BBC. I would love to do another film. It just has to be the right one and work with the schedule, which is not always easy. I'm just thankful for my job on Top Chef at this point.
Of course. Padma, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care, Matthew.
All right, you too.
And to wrap up today's edition of Film Sociology, Werner Herzog.
Age-old dream of flying was realized for the first time in the late 18th century. And like a fever dream of the ensuing mechanical age, engineers devised all manner of motorized contraptions. Some of them imitated the flight of birds. That did not go anywhere. But bold aviators had more practical dreams. They would fly machines that today are known as aeroplanes. Some of them resembled boats with wings. They were fragile, and often things went wrong. Aviation had its early disappointments and groundings, but that did not deter others from pursuing the great purpose. But what to do with passengers? Were these planes powerful enough to carry people, and if so, where to tuck them away? Not much later, stronger engines allowed for greater payload, and planes were built like taxis.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
That will about do it for another edition of Film Sociology. Good, go see a good movie. You deserve it. And don't forget, next week, Friday, May 31st, and Saturday, June 1st, Midnight Movies return to Keystone Landmark Theaters with Anchorman. So get ready. I know I will be watching it this weekend, getting ready for it, and I will be there. Hope to see you there as well. This has been Film Sociology, a film talk show on WFYI, HD2 The Point, and WFYI.org. We gone. Good night, Fort Myers.